Welcome to Trained, a podcast exploring the cutting edge of holistic fitness. I'm Ryan Flaherty, the Senior Director of Performance at Nike. On every episode, I call up the world's leading experts and athletes to talk about mindset, movement, nutrition, recovery, and sleep. All the ways to train your body and mind. Today, I'm connecting with a psychotherapist who believes that the way we look at chronic pain can change the way we feel it.
When the brain and the nervous system are in high alert, many signals are going off in your body. Once you put a label on yourself, I have a migraine disorder, I have fibromyalgia, I have chronic pelvic pain, the first thing you think is, how is it going to limit my life? How is it going to take away from my ability to make money, my ability to connect with my children, my ability to be a good partner, my ability to have fun with my friends? And that meaning continues to snowball into the nervous system being on higher alert, and now we're in this negative cycle of it feeding itself into more and more pain.
That's psychotherapist, author, and podcast hero, Nicole Sachs, on how the anxiety we feel about pain can contribute to that pain. People who work out are no strangers to everyday aches. A lot of us, myself included, have had run-ins with acute pain and big success stories with physical therapy. But what about when pain sticks around after treatment? Or what if we can't get a straight diagnosis in the first place? That's where Nicole Sachs comes in. She looks at chronic pain as a misunderstanding between body and mind. Whether it starts with emotional trauma or physical injury is kind of chicken or egg. Either way, you've got a cycle from pain to fear and right back to pain. Sachs says the place to break that cycle is our nervous system's command center, the brain. But it's not as simple as flipping a mental switch. Her techniques require dedicated daily practice and plenty of reps, just like any physical modality. Today we explore a few of those techniques, and we learn how they help Sachs herself turn a life of chronic pain into a life of constant growth, fierce athleticism, and service to others. Hey, Nicole, how you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
Good. Thanks for taking the time to join us today. I appreciate it.
Absolutely.
So pain is a complex topic, and you know, it can be structural, it can be cognitive, and it can be chemical. How do you define pain?
What I've really learned about pain is that pain is information. Pain is an invitation in my work to bring us to the precipice of real deep inner truth, whether that be things we need to do for ourselves or just things we need to know about ourselves. There's no cure for the human condition, and good, because we're here to live and drink in all the beauty of being alive. But there's also no cure for human pain. What there is a cure for, however, is chronic pain, because chronic pain of any kind is an epidemic of fear. And that's something that really fuels my work in helping people understand how fear leads to the nervous system being in sustained fight or flight, which leads to more and more pain.
All of my experience with pain has been acute. But I can only imagine someone who's dealing with chronic pain to hear that it's probably in some way more of a mindset, mental health, you know, some form of impact of fear or trauma or stress related. It's got to be really hard to hear. So can you talk a little bit about how you've landed on that fear is what's fueling the chronic pain and that it is something that we can get over or heal from?
Thank you so much for asking that, because that is the number one misconception and misunderstanding about this work, this mind-body work that I do. The pain is not in your head. You are not making it up. You are not creating it. You are not dramatic. You're not too sensitive. It's not psychological and it's not psychosomatic. So let me just throw all of that right out there.
Yeah, thanks for saying that. Yeah.
The pain is not in your head. This is brain science. And so I think the best way, Ryan, for me to explain what I mean here is to tell people what I'm teaching, they already believe. And when I start to enter through that door, people can understand. So like, let's say I'm talking to a lecture hall before COVID of, you know, hundreds of people. And I would say, okay, raise your hand if anyone's had a stressful day and gotten a headache. Every hand in the room goes up, because who among us has not had a stressful day and gotten a headache? And I said, okay, now raise your hand if you went for a CAT scan the next morning. Very few people raise their hand unless, of course, they're having a very catastrophic incident. Okay, so next, who among us hasn't gotten bad news or a phone call, you know, and you look at your phone and it says mom at 1 a.m. and hasn't gotten a sick stomach immediately? You know, emotional stimuli lead to physical sensations. Mm-hmm. And the biggest, most obvious one is what happens to us when we're really, really moved or really, really touched or sad? water falls out of our face. The ultimate physical reaction to an emotional stimuli. So what I want people to understand, especially when it comes to chronic pain, because chronic pain is such a raw and touchy subject, is for people to understand that the human process of an emotional stimuli leading to a physical reaction is something that every person believes in until it becomes chronic. I have this concept that I teach called pre-grieving, where we are worrying in advance about things that we will never get to do. This creates a tremendous meaning, and meaning creates the nervous system moving from rest and repair to fight or flight. Because we have to start preparing for how we're going to protect ourselves. And this is an incredibly intuitive process that we have no control over. You know, your nervous system doesn't ask your permission, nor does it ask your opinion before it saves your life. We don't put our hand on a hot stove and say, maybe a little hot, I don't know, maybe. No, you pull it off without even thinking about it, because that's your nervous system at work. That's the beauty of the human animal. We don't get to choose. And that's why we're still alive and still thriving as a species. Pain isn't just, ouch, my shoulder, ouch, my back, ouch, my head. It's fibromyalgia. It's irritable bowel disease. It's any sort of systemic skin problem. It's the symptoms of autoimmune disease. It's any time the nervous system is involved and in sustained chronic stress, it makes our entire body wire differently. Digestion shuts down. Circulation is changed. Respiration is changed. This is anxiety. Oh my God, anxiety and the physical sensations of anxiety. It's such a big deal. So to put a bow on that, the pain is not in your head, and the solution is not in altering your physical body. And that's, for over 20 years of experience, has shown me that time and again.
It's been fascinating for me to see, watch, you know, some football players as an example, or track and field athletes who are, you know, some of the strongest minded people on the planet that I've ever been around, that will at some point get an injury that then turns into a chronic pain issue. And you could just tell, like, over the course of a period of months to sometimes years, if they're dealing with that long, that just wearing down of their mental health and mental state to just want to give up.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, the support system around them, especially in professional athletes in North America, is very unhealthy in a way, where they just say, you know, push through the pain, come on, like, you know, get over it or get out of here. And so these athletes think there's something inherently wrong with them when,
yes,
you know,
there's a lot of shame. There's a lot of shame attached to chronic pain.
Yeah. What is your personal experience with it?
Yeah. So I had probably an aching back through my teen years, but nothing that ever stopped me. When I was 19 years old, my back went out. I was absolutely unable to move or to walk. My parents had to come to college and bring me physically home. And I went through all the tests, and I had a consult with an orthopedic surgeon who told me, you have a condition called degenerative spondylolisthesis, which is a severe abnormality of the lower spine. And I do have it, and I still have it on MRI, which is very important to know. But it was a finding that makes a lot of sense to me now, that that caused my doctor to tell me that I would need to quit all sports, quit all travel, no longer lift anything that was more than 10 pounds. I would have to sleep in very specific situations, either fetal position or my knees elevated. I couldn't ride in a bouncy car for more than an hour at a time. And the likelihood that I would have biological children was very slim because of the weight of the baby on my back. And you can only imagine what it would feel like at any age to get that kind of news. But at 19, it was a life changer in a very, very dark way. And it sent me into a life completely fueled by fear. I, of course, with no alternative information, believed the surgeon wholeheartedly, and started to mourn, you know, what it would mean that I would never have these things. And the children thing was especially painful for me, because I was one of those young people who really fantasized about being a mom. It was just a huge blow. And what went through my mind was, first, a tremendous mourning, but second, in conjunction, sort of in parallel to that mourning, was a bit of what I would call a spiritual understanding that maybe that wouldn't be my fate. I had no words for it. I didn't have any sort of real connection to what that meant, but there was an openness in me that I didn't understand that led me to find Dr. John Sarno's work, who is the pioneer of mind-body medicine. And so when I found his work, I began to open my mind really, really wide because I didn't want that to be my fate. And, you know, to give people sort of the sweet ending, I have three beautiful, incredible biological children. I exercise till the day they were born. I am an athlete. I am a cyclist. I am a runner. I have absolutely no pain from doing this work. And I have the exact same findings on MRI.
At what point did you say to yourself, like, maybe the surgeon is wrong and I want to do kind of my own homework? How did that happen?
Well, when the surgeon first gave me the diagnosis, what he said is, listen, you're 19 years old, you're young, you're healthy, and if you don't plan to go into manual labor, which I did not, you will not need the surgery yet. But he said I wouldn't live till 40 without spinal fusion surgery, which at the time, and you have to remember this was 1990, yeah, he said would require 6 weeks in a body cast and decreased mobility for life. I know that technology has improved and it's probably not nearly quite an ordeal now. But that's what he was saying to me at the time. So although I had this diagnosis and all these limitations, I was not tasked to decide about the surgery at the moment. So I kind of had this like middle time to just live. And in that, I found Dr. Sarno. What happened to me was when I discovered the book Healing Back Pain, which was the book he wrote before the Mind-Body Prescription, my mother had heard about it on TV and she told me to buy this book. So I didn't really read the book. I always say this just to be very, very honest because I'm nothing if not authentic. I was in my early 20s and I was like, whatever, what's this about? You know, I kind of skimmed through it. And this is how I understood it at the time, that when we have pain in our bodies, yes, we're feeling it through our bodies. Yes, the pain is absolutely real, absolutely felt through the body. What every doctor will agree on, even if there aren't widely accepted studies, is that you can't feel anything if they cut your head off. Right. Okay? You need your brain. It doesn't mean that the pain isn't real. It's that the nervous system and the brain control every single thing that we feel. And so, you know, I was a curious young person. I kind of got that. And so I decided to do a science experiment on myself because I was a psych. First of all, at the time I was in grad school for psychology. So why not? You know, I was doing experiments on other people, may as well do an experiment on myself. And so when I was experiencing my acute pain flare-ups, I would sort of press the internal pause. I'm big on pressing pause because it gives us space to respond instead of react. And I would ask into myself, why are you so angry? I just asked that question. And I gave myself the permission to tell the truth. Nobody was listening but me. Everything was happening up here. And I would tell the truth, some ugly stuff, you know, some really inappropriate ugly stuff of why I was so angry and why life was unfair and why I was such a victim and, you know, whatever I was feeling at the time, which turned out not to stay true, but I would say it. And then I would attend to my back. Like 10 minutes later, I would kind of forget about it because I'd be busy doing whatever I was doing. And I would go, huh, my goodness, it doesn't hurt right now. And it was that spark, that crack in the shell that let a little bit of light in at the time that I was like, maybe there's something to this.
You've talked before about, you know, being able to rationalize the pain away. What are the benefits and limitations of that type of thinking?
I'll go with the limitations first.
Yeah, please.
Because the great limitation of that is that it's not, you're not telling the truth. Listen, we all know that an athlete in the moment who is bathed in adrenaline is often able to show up for that moment, you know, get back on the basketball court and finish the game. But that will not be an enduring, healthy solution. You can't lie to yourself. You can't. You can in the moment maybe, and it can be a brief Band-Aid on the situation, but I do not see in my practice and in my travels long-term recovery from that kind of self-talk. Because you know what you're feeling and your fear, like I just said about the nervous system, how it doesn't ask your permission or your opinion, your fear is going to rise within you. Your dread, your grief, your sadness, your terror, all those feelings, which are so human. There is no shame in feeling those feelings because those feelings are necessary for being a human being. I'll tell you something that I hear about a lot. People have a knee issue or a back issue or shoulder issue and they get the surgery. Okay. And they come to me or to my work somehow, and they say, you know, it's the craziest thing. I got the back surgery and actually I had tremendous relief. For 2 or 3 months, I had no back pain. And then from nowhere, my knee injury from when I was 14 started flaring up and now I can't walk. When this process is being enacted in our body, and it's not a threat, it's just information, it needs to be treated at the source, which is in our emotional world. Even though emotions sound like they're not important, they're triggering the nervous system to do something physical. So this is not saying, you know, oh, poor sweet baby, you have to feel better about like your mean dad. I'm saying if we don't talk about your mean dad, then your nervous system is going to be in as if a predator is chasing you all the time. And if a predator is chasing you all the time, there will be pain signals sent to your body to have you slow down and hide in the bush because it thinks you're not going to be able to outrun it. So, you know, I know it's hard for people sometimes to come to this understanding, but it's imperative for people to know that it's happening.
Can you talk about your moment in your life where you experienced that moment of surrender, where you're ready to kind of just like do the hard work?
I had 2 out of my 3 children, and I was living a very free life. And then one day when my son was 10 months old, so my daughter was 2 and my son was 10 months old, I had my kids really close together. He was in a little baby walker and he was toddling around my deck, and I didn't want the walker to go over the 2 steps that went from my deck to the driveway. So I thought, oh, no big deal. My back is fine, which it is, but this is a longer story. And I picked up the walker, kind of leaned over it, and people who have bad backs kind of like wince when I say this, but I leaned over it and I gently set it down on the driveway, and it felt like a hot knife was dragging through my back. And quite frankly, it was like the hot knife of shame. It was like, okay, well, you did it now. You should have listened to the surgeon. You pushed your luck. You had 2 kids, and now you're having the same back pain as when you were 19, and you're ruined. You're ruined. You've ruined it. You know, I mean, it's all those human thoughts that come cascading in. And that led to the darkest year of my life because I was in horrible chronic pain. I was in physical therapy 3 days a week, electric stim treatments to the back, steroid packs, opioid pain medications, muscle relaxers, and I cried myself to sleep every night. I was a bad mom. I mean, the word bad is kind of rough, but I was angry. I was impatient. I had 2 really little kids. And I was just really getting through it breath to breath. It was a very difficult year. And the moment of surrender culminated. I was at a deli with my little ones, and I was trying to pay at the front of the deli, right where they have those beautiful displays of like gummy bears and chocolate covered pretzels and all that stuff, right at the eye level of like a 2-foot tall person. So my little ones, who let's call them spirited instead of monsters, were grabbing the stuff off the shelves, and they're like, I want this, I want this. They're like dancing around, and I'm mortified, and I'm also in pain, and I'm also feeling totally out of control, and I was also feeling 1,000 other things that I didn't know about. Because one of the things that people need to understand about this process that I'm teaching and explaining is, what you know you feel is just the iceberg above the water. What you really need to get to is often hidden in the depths of the ocean because it's underneath the surface. So I didn't know everything that was going on, but what I knew is this is not cool right now. I finished paying. I got my 2 kids and I'm walking them to the car, and I'm feeling as I'm walking them to the car, my back tense up and tighten, and just the pain and the panic starts just flooding my whole body. And I get them to my car and I can't get them in the car. And this is an incredibly active parking lot. And these are 2 toddlers. If I had let go of either of their wrists, they could have been instantly hit by a car. And I, short of screaming for someone to help me that was a stranger, which I wasn't that low, I wasn't willing to do, I just held onto their wrists and I just leaned my forehead on the driver's side window of my car and I just sobbed. I sobbed for my ruined life and my poor children that were going to have to endure this failure of a parent. And it was just the lowest moment. And I don't know how long we stood there, but my kids just surrendered too. You know, kids, like they have this intuitive knowing, like, this is not a time to complain, you know, and they just kind of stood there limply. And eventually, somehow, I got them in the car, I got them home, I got them bathed into bed. And I remember sitting on my bed, looking out, they had this big picture window, and I could see the trees and I could see the stars, and I gave up. I surrendered. I said, I don't know if Dr. Sarno is right with all this mind-body stuff that feels like nonsense right now, or I don't know if the surgeon's right and I'm on my way to this horribly limited life of spinal fusion surgery and all this stuff they told me, but mess with me, don't mess with my kids. I will do anything. And that's when I went into New York City. Dr. Sarno, who has since passed away, was in practice at NYU at the time. And I went and saw him, And he really explained to me what it was to do the work, which I had not understood. Mm. I thought it was just a mindset shift, and it is a mindset shift. It is very important that it's a mindset shift, but it's so much more than that.
Yeah.
That's basically the first day of the rest of my life, because I understood what the work was. I started doing it for myself, and in doing it for myself, I created all the programs that I now have spent my entire life's work teaching.
After the break, we'll move on from Sack's philosophy and get into her methods, exploring the daily practices she's used to heal her chronic pain from the inside out.
If you're enjoying this episode of Trained, here's some good news. You'll find more wellness expertise every day on Nike.com, the Nike app, the Nike Run Club app, and the Nike Training Club app. You can learn more about mindset, movement, nutrition, recovery, and sleep, and you can get started on a workout as soon as you finish this episode.
So for people that are listening that are experiencing chronic pain or know someone that is, where do you start and what does the work look like?
So I often say there are three facets to my work: believe, do the work, and patience and kindness for yourself. So believe is what you and I have been talking about thus far in this whole conversation of just understanding what's happening, understanding that it is brain science, it's not in your head and it's not your fault, and then becoming willing to do the work is really believe. That's the facet of believe. I'll tell you a little bit about how Do the Work was born. So I went to Dr. Sarno. He explained to me that what we need to do to stop the process of chronic pain in the body is we need to move the nervous system from fight or flight to rest and repair. We need to move ourselves from the constant onslaught of trying to protect us from these repressed emotions to peace and freedom, to consciousness. And those words sometimes sound a little woo-woo. This is straight up brain science, and it really made sense to me at the time. Also, I had my master's degree, and I did have some education around this, so it was making sense to me. And he said, one of the best ways to move your feelings and thoughts from your repressed subconscious into the conscious mind is to journal. Because journaling slows your thoughts down enough to open yourself to epiphany, to open yourself to maybe new ways of thinking about things. And I had always been okay with journaling. I had kept diaries as a kid, you know, here and there. So I was like, okay, cool, whatever. It kind of seemed like that doesn't feel like something important or big enough to change the way my body feels, but okay, I'll journal. But he explained that we should make three lists. Childhood, which could also be known as past stressors, just a bulleted list, daily life, you know, your spouse, your money, your work, your pain, and then your personality. And oftentimes, those people that are most afflicted by these kind of chronic conditions are people who fall under the same category, which is perfectionist, you're your own worst critic, you're a goodist, you want to always be seen as a good person, it's very important to you that people like you, it's very important for you to do your best, to be seen as like a person achieving. It's type A. It's people who really put a lot of pressure on themselves are often people that need to repress a lot of their emotions by necessity. And so essentially the lists are bulleted lists based on memories from childhood that you know might not be resolved, daily life stressors, and personality. So I made these bulleted lists, and he said, time yourself. At the time, he was saying I should be doing it for quite a long time. I've kind of pared it back to a 20-minute practice because I wanted to make it reasonable for people to do. So set your timer for, let's say, 20 minutes, and just pick a topic, any of your bullets, and write. Just free write. Just dump out the, you know, what's going on. And so I was doing it. And I was feeling, quite frankly, a whole lot of nothing. You know, I was writing, I was playing my tapes, I was telling the stories of my childhood, and woe is me in sixth grade, and woe is me over money, and woe is me over moving a lot. And it was true. I was telling the truth, but it somehow didn't feel like this would be something that could ever impact my health. And so I was moving right along, and I picked motherhood. And I put motherhood at the top of the page, and I started writing, once again, telling the truth, the surface truth, which is I have two babies. My husband, who is now my ex-husband, but we're really good friends, at the time was like super workaholic, and he was never home, and I felt very alone. And so I'm, you know, telling the story. And there was just, once again, I can only call it some sort of a spiritual awakening, something a little bigger than me, kind of tapped on my shoulder and said, "Hey, Nicole, you're lying." And I was like, "What do you mean I'm lying? I'm not lying. This what's happening to me." And the voice just said, "No, honey, you got to tell the truth. You are not repressing the fact that you have two kids in cribs. This is, everyone knows that. What's going on?" And at that moment, I wrote the first line of journal speak ever penned. And it was, "I hate being a mother." And if you could only know the power of those words, the bitter acid of them coming out of me, because not only did I want to be a mom since I was 10, but I was told I wouldn't be. And now through this miracle of my understanding of mind-body medicine, I had gotten to be, and I hated it. It was wrong. I was tired. I was used up. I had the wrong kids. They didn't look like me. They screamed in my face. They didn't sleep. They didn't like to eat anything. And every mother out there, I hope, is laughing because it's like that. Okay. It's just like that when you're little.
I have two little kids. I get it.
Okay. Okay, good. So, but what I want to say is what's magical and beautiful about this process is it just opened me up. It like ripped the Band-Aid off of what I had no idea I had been repressing. And out came all that hatred and all that anger, but it suddenly began to transform. And I was like, wait a minute. You don't hate your two beautiful kids. What's going on here, Nicole? Who do you hate? And then it went right to my parents. And I don't know if I'm allowed to swear on this podcast, so I won't, but it was, you know.
We'll bleep it out.
Okay. You I can't believe it. And you ruined my freaking life. And, you know, and the vent, the letter you will never send. I never had to give this to my parents. This is not about changing your life or changing your relationships. It is a gift to yourself. And I'm talking. And all of a sudden that began to transform. I found compassion somewhere in there. And I was like, what else is there? There's more in there. And wow, did it just turn on me. I hated myself. You weak, stupid, little failure. You can't be strong enough to get past this. You can't raise kids. Everybody raises kids, you know. So it just went on and on and on. And at the end of this dump of emotions, of this reckless and shameless telling of the truth, I was sort of this puddle of incredible self-compassion. And I woke up the next morning and I was 80% pain-free, which has never returned. Over the next couple months, I did the work. I really buckled down. I did my journal speak. I did meditation. I started really practicing patience and kindness for myself. I stopped being such an asshole to myself all the time and telling myself what a failure I was. I started to have some kindness, some self-compassion, which is like so something I teach a lot at my retreats and something we really need. It's like a big deal.
100%. Yeah. We talk about this on the podcast all the time about being your own best friend.
Yeah. You know? I mean, you must. It's not optional anymore because it's making you sick. And so, you know, so basically over the next couple months, I became absolutely, completely, 100% back pain free. It has never returned. I had another child. I am a serious athlete and I'm almost 50 and my body feels younger than when I was probably in college. And it is all because my nervous system no longer flares into fight or flight. I know how I feel about things and it doesn't mean I have to change my life. I change my life if I choose, but that is my choice and it is separate of this. It doesn't mean I had to disown my kids and kill my parents and run off to Mexico. It is all right here and it is amazing.
My mom passed away when I was young from cancer and I kind of like as the older brother never really processed the emotion of it. I kind of did the whole ostrich, buried my head in the sand, kind of did the strong brother for my sisters. And then later on, obviously in my 20s, it came back and it was something I had to really go back and work through and grieve properly. But of all the therapists I talked to, all the people I talked to, mentors, everyone kept bringing up this journaling, like, you know, you got to journal. And it was like as if there was like this internal like anxiety block where I was like, yeah, like what's that going to do? I won't do anything. And I did it very similar to you, tried it a few times, felt nothing. So like this is crap. There's nothing here. And it wasn't until I went to this workshop where we actually wrote letters and we had to write letters that no one would ever see and you were going to read.
Right.
We were reading them in groups and whatnot. And it was like, it was the most transformational experience I've ever had.
Yes.
But it's like, to your point, I think the hard part is for a lot of people is like people who have journaled before, it's not this like you journal one time and all of a sudden you have this massive epiphany. I think what ultimately happens is you just start to work through, right? It's just like, at some point all your subconscious starts to like let go and you'll start to write things, say things that you just didn't know were in there.
So it starts with the three lists because the lists are just kind of a landscape of your life, right? We just want to get a sense of where we're stuck. And I always say the list should be exhaustive, just a total brain dump of everything you can think of. And it might never be that you have to end up journaling about that bullet point. So I don't want people to be scared like, oh shit, there's 300 things on my list. I'm never getting through this. It doesn't matter. It's really just an exercise in taking stock, sort of taking inventory of what's in there. You know, so, and it could be anything from that time in third grade with the bully. Nobody needs to understand these lists but you. It's just about you getting it out and on paper. It could also be big things. Like one of my bullets was always money because my parents were very financially unstable. And so we had to move a lot because we didn't have the money to stay where we were. And that affected my life dramatically because I had to keep making new friends. So, you know, there's all sorts of things. And then the daily life, obvious stuff, you know, your relationships. I put on daily life, there should be the name of every member of your family. Boom, 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 boom. And then, of course, anything else, you know, your job, your boss, you know, you don't like your butt. Like, I don't care what it is, you know, it goes on the list. And then, of course, the personality is what I explained earlier. And you use those lists to fuel your journal speak practice at the beginning. I never go back to lists anymore. You know, I mean, I've been doing this for 25 years, but I would say that, you know, it's okay to start with the lists. It's good to start with the lists. And then it's also okay to sometimes sit down to your journal speak and just say, what am I feeling right now? You know, oftentimes people say, I'm having trouble connecting to my feelings. And I say, well, you have to start at the surface, right? We start with the surface truth. We look at what's going on in the moment. And then if you keep writing about the surface truth like a court reporter, you will be invited to dig. You'll get like an itch and you'll go, oh, God, I don't want to think about that. That's the one. Mm-hmm. And then you end up going deeper. Realize that journal speak gets destroyed the moment you are done. This is not something you keep. As one of my dear former clients says, it's like blowing your nose in a tissue, throw it away. I like to open up a blank document. I used to write longhand, whatever speaks to you.
Can you like voice dictate?
Yeah, people ask me that. Here's my take on voice. If you can't possibly write, meaning if carpal tunnel is your chronic pain, if you're getting vertigo and you can't look at a page, like if you absolutely can't write, you can speak it. But the reason I like writing is we have a monkey mind up here. Mm-hmm. You know, Ram Dass describes the mind as a drunk monkey who was just stung by a scorpion and like spun in a circle. Like the mind goes from one thing to another and it's so quick to try to rationalize and it's so quick to try to save us from our discomfort that when you have to slow your thoughts down to at least vaguely, even though everything's misspelled and there's terrible grammar, vaguely get it down on some sort of a piece of paper, I believe it opens you to epiphany. And because journaling it often meets with such resistance, that's helpful information. Because resistance is just part of the process. Resistance is just the nervous system saying, no, no, don't look over there. Yeah. And, you know, and so when I feel resistance, and resistance, by the way, comes to you in your own voice and sounds very, very legitimate. And resistance, oh, come on, this is crap. You don't need to, this, how's that going to help you? That's resistance.
Yeah.
Resistance is, you're too tired. I'm too tired. I can't do this. Resistance is, I've got 1,000 other things to do. And it comes in your own voice. And when I hear my resistance, I say, thank you for sharing. I love you too. We're going to do this now, okay? Your nervous system basically is like the mentality of a small child.
Mm-hmm.
Things are either good or bad. They're happy or sad. You're safe or you're not safe. You know, the nervous system doesn't have much gray. And so it's really about understanding that the voice of journal speak is the voice of a 5-year-old kid an hour before dinner. They're starving and they want the whole bag of cookies and you just said no. That's the voice. I want it raw. I want it real. I want you to tell the terrible, awful, impolite, imperfect truth because it's saving your life in a way that you won't get until it starts to happen to you.
Yeah, what you're describing is something that I know people really begin to notice during meditation.
Absolutely. Your nervous system and your brain cannot calm down, cannot rewire those neural pathways that have been wired for pain, for discomfort, for inattention, for all the things that we struggle with as human beings. They can't rewire unless you slow down and you do this kind of work. So I am a crazy person, okay? My brain goes at 1,000 miles an hour. I'm a New Yorker. I'm super fast. Everywhere I go fast. And I thought to myself when I first heard about meditation, oh God, well, that's for other people, not for this, not for this crazy. Anybody can meditate as long as you take the shame out of doing it wrong. You will have your brain go everywhere. You will lose your train of thought. You will get a train of thought. You will do your grocery list. You will fall asleep sitting up. It doesn't matter. Just try it. Because like any other thing in life, it is a practice, and practice takes repetition. Start with 5 minutes a day. You can start with a guided meditation. I have built my meditation practice with this crazy person that you're hearing from to 30 minutes of silent meditation every morning, and it is non-negotiable. It changes the way I go through my whole entire day, and I just can't say enough to just try it and to take the shame out of doing it wrong and to take the certainty away that it can't be true for you.
Yeah. Every time I work with a new athlete coming out of college, I start with meditation, kind of a part of the agreement working with me. That's something you do. And without fail, every time they always go, well, I'm not good at it. I'm not good at that. Yeah. It's like, nobody's good
right.
at it.
No.
Like, it's funny because I have had Andy Puta come from Headspace to work with a lot of my athletes. And he always talks about how he doesn't know a single Tibetan Buddhist monk who's been in meditation for 30 years that is good at it. Right. It's like,
exactly.
No one can quiet their mind. It's impossible. I heard you say that something about chronic pain is an epidemic of fear. And I think when you look in society today, look across the world, fear is an epidemic 100%. I mean, you can't turn on news without feeling right, some sense of like fear based on what they're sharing with you. Can you just tell me a little bit about what you mean by that?
Okay, so pain is inevitable. Okay, so people say, what if I drop a hammer on my foot? You know, you're going to tell me that I have to journal? No. I'm not insane. Okay, everybody, I'm a normal girl. Pain is inevitable. Human pain is inevitable. The human condition requires us to experience both pleasure and pain. It's the fabric of life. So chronic pain is an epidemic of fear, because pain can only be perpetuated when we are putting all our energy toward fearing it, putting meaning attached to it. And this has a lot to do with pre-grieving. And everything comes back to the source, which is the brain and the nervous system and the dance that the brain and the nervous system are doing with your body. If the brain and the nervous system are in high alert, many signals are going off in your body. And so really, when I say it's an epidemic of fear, I just mean that once you put a label on yourself, I have a migraine disorder, I have fibromyalgia, I have chronic pelvic pain, I have a bad knee, a bad back, a bad hip, a bad this and that, the first thing you think is, how is it going to limit my life? How is it going to take away from my ability to make money, my ability to connect with my children, my ability to be a good partner, my ability to have fun with my friends? And that meaning continues to snowball into the nervous system being on higher alert. And now we're in this negative cycle of it feeding itself into more and more pain.
So I want to end on this one, because I love this quote that you said that at home having kids, you say you can't heal all your wounds by throwing your children the best birthday party. Can you explain what that means to you and how listeners can apply that mindset to, you know, their daily small struggles?
Yes. Okay. So this does apply very strongly to parenting. So I'll just kind of throw it out to the parents there, but I think it can really apply to anything. You cannot heal your deep wounds of childhood by making your life perfect today. You cannot go back and rescue your 10-year-old sweet self who cried him or herself to sleep by making your kids, you know, the most privileged, wonderful people who have the birthday party of a lifetime. It's nice to give them a nice birthday party, and I'm sure they want one. But if we continue to try to fix our deepest pain by being super shiny, successful people today, we steal from our ability to heal, and we often make ourselves really sick, because that just adds more anxiety and more anxiety. Because what happens is you have a child who is just a human, who's just doing their best to get through life, and you start giving them things like the best birthday party, and you start wanting and needing this to fix them or fix you. It's just, it's a really, really difficult scenario to be in because it's never going to work. What does work is going back, being unafraid, opening the curtain, going into your darkest room and turning on the light and sitting with you, that scared, pimply, chubby, whatever you were that you didn't like, that kid is aching for your attention. I want to also just send out a lot of empathy and compassion for those of us, and I include myself in it, that do throw the biggest birthday party and want that to be the answer. You know, like forgive yourself for wanting that to be the answer. Forgive yourself for wanting to, you know, in terms of athletics, like be the best, win the game, have the shortest sprint, you know, whatever it is, because that is the way we've been taught to overcome. And unfortunately, it is actually the opposite. We need to slow down and we need to look within, and that's where the real healing lies.
Nicole, thank you so much. It's impossible in one podcast to cover everything you do, but I think it's a great start.
Thank you so much for having me.
Slow down. That advice can be a hard pill to swallow for driven people like me. But these days, it feels even more important to let our engines cool down once in a while. Here's another point Nicole made that I'll be thinking about all week. Making mindset changes can generate physiological results. It's not mysterious, magical, or woo-woo. It's an everyday event. That idea got me thinking about another episode we did a while back, my interview with psychologist Aaliyah Crum. Her studies showed that changes in mindset could alter hormones, amplify workouts, and even help us heal. That episode's a great companion to this one on the research side, so I seriously recommend you go back and give it a listen. Of course, you could listen to all the episodes, but you still need to do the work. To see how journaling could change your sensations, you need to get out the pen and paper and get into the tough stuff. To find out how meditation can change your mindset, you need to sit your ass down and watch all your crazy thoughts come up. And since the best time to get started is always right now, you've got my okay to take 5 minutes off binging the podcast. This has been Trained. Talk to you soon. If you've enjoyed this episode of Trained, help us spread the word by rating and reviewing the podcast. That way we can keep making great episodes for you to listen to. And it helps other people find us too. If you've got a question for me or my guests, or a topic you'd like to see covered, email me at trained@nike.com, and I'll see what I can do.
Thanks for listening to Trained. Just a reminder, always talk with your doctor before starting any training or nutrition program. The information we provide isn't a substitute for any medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment, and the individual opinions expressed here are just that, opinions.